Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Rates and Lanes with your hosts, Rico Muhammad and Chuck Snow.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to the Rates and Lanes podcast. I'm your host, Rico Muhammad. Be joined shortly by my co-host, Mr. Chuck Snow. We have some exciting guests lined up for you guys this evening. Without any further ado, thank you guys for tuning in. Let's go ahead and get into the proceedings this evening. So diesel fuel prices remained unchanged for the week. We're still sitting at a national average price of $3.19 per gallon on average for diesel fuel. Shippers that traditionally make a dock clearing push at the end of the month and end of the quarter, but only modest spot volume increases were recorded last week. Dry van and reefer volumes rose less than 3%, while the flatbed market remains hot amid the tightest capacity we've seen since the Great Recession. In 2018, a strong industrial economy drove spot rates higher than contract rates for more than half of the year. This year, spot rates are already 20 cents per mile higher than the same time in the same week of 2018, and just a few pennies shy of the record high set on June 14th of 2018. So with that being said, let's take a look and see how the rates were performing over the previous week, starting out with dry vans. Starting out in the northeastern portion of the United States, we have dry vans averaging $2.49 per mile on average. Moving down to the mid-Atlantic and southeastern states, we're showing an average spot market rate for dry vans at $2.61. Moving up into the Midwest, we're showing an average outbound rate of $3.02. Dropping down to the south central region, we're showing an average outbound rate of $2.32. And coming out of the West Coast, we're showing an average outbound rate of $2.65. Moving over to the national flatbed spot market rate, starting out in the northeastern portion of the United States, we are showing an average spot rate at $2.78 in the Northeast. Moving down to the mid-Atlantic and southeastern states, we're showing an average spot market rate of $2.96 per mile. Moving up into the Midwest, we're showing an average outbound spot market rate of $3.20 per mile. Down in the south central region of the United States, we're showing average outbound rates at $2.44 for flatbeds. And wrapping up, coming out of the West Coast, we're showing average rates at $2.35. And wrapping up the temperature-controlled or reefer portion of the report, starting out in the northeast, we're showing average outbound rates at $2.70. Moving down to the mid-Atlantic and southeast, showing average outbound rates at $2.66. Midwest leading the charge, showing a whopping $3.41 per mile on average. Coming out of the south central region, we're showing an average rate of $2.77. And coming out of the west coast, wrapping up, we're showing an average outbound spot market rate of $2.95. And we do not have anything to report as far as the bad broker report. Seems like everybody's paying their bills these days, but we don't have any delinquent bad brokers that are making any waves as far as the FMCSA has been concerned so far this year. And like we said last week, that's always a very good thing. And without any further ado, let me welcome in my co-host, Mr. Chuck Snow. Good evening, Chuck. How are you?
We're doing well. How are you, Rico?
I'm doing much better than I was doing last week, Chuck.
So, yeah, we definitely...
Say again.
Kudos to you last week for showing up, because you were in a lot of pain. I'm glad you're sounding so much better this week.
Well, yeah, I'm excited for tonight's show. We've got a whopper of a topic, and I think we've got some whoppers of a guest as normal. So I'm kind of looking forward to the fireworks again.
Yeah, I agree. And to our listeners, if you want to get in on this, press 1. But what we're doing tonight is we've brought on Tommy Rook, who we know is Professor Truck Insurance, and our resident legal genius, Hank Seaton, who probably knows more about transportation law than anybody else in the United States. And we're going to have a friendly discussion, we hope to remain friendly, on the concept of allowing 18-year-olds to run interstate. Now, as a fleet owner, I have to say that we do not permit new drivers to work for us. Our insurance company is asking for 3 years. Now, however, there are a couple of schools around that if, and I don't know about now, but I know that historically, if drivers came from either of those two schools, the insurance company used to automatically look at that as 3 years interstate experience. So there are some good schools, but as I was saying to Rico before the show, there are some really, really bad schools out there, including some of them that are run by the mega carriers. You know, they're just bringing people in that don't know a truck from a bowling ball and giving them very, very basic training. And, of course, now with automated transmissions, it's a lot less training even in that aspect, giving them the bare minimum and sending them out on the road. If you can do that with a 40-year-old person that's worked at a grocery store or worked at a software company or worked on an auto assembly line, why can't you do it with an 18-year-old? And let's throw this to our experts, Tommy Root and Hank Seaton. Welcome to both of you.
There, hold on 1 second. Now we got them both locked in.
Okay.
Thank you. Okay.
Got everybody there?
All right, gentlemen.
Yep, we're here.
Yes, sir.
Okay. I'm here.
Hank, you and I talked about this recently, and you actually said, I'd love to see what Tommy Rook says about this. Tommy, you've got your finger on the heartbeat of the insurance industry. What is the insurance industry saying about this? Because we've got a problem in our industry. We're running out of drivers.
Well, that first is the problem that we have. When you called me, I hadn't read it yet because this week's Transport Topics editorial is about the SMART Act. And there is a part of that act, and I think Hank will agree with me, that has some merit, and that is increasing standards for drivers' training before they can get a CDL. And that's a positive thing that's a part of it. And the other anomaly we have here, and they make this example in Indiana, but you can go from in Indiana from Indianapolis down to Albany at 18, but you can't go from Albany to Cincinnati, which is across the river, unless you're 21.
Right.
Florida's the same way. So there is things that are here. Where I'm here in the insurance industry and something that I agree with is forget the state lines. What my concern is I don't think an 18-year-old, I don't think any insurance carrier, and we'll talk about an exception in this for retentions and things like this, is going to let someone drive over the road. However, why not limit it to they have to stay within a 300-mile radius, meaning they have to come home every day, you know, dedicated route,
right,
something like that, part of it. Once they get some basic training, and two things happen there. First, they're coming home, so they don't have to deal with all that on-road situations. And second is, if they got quasi-dedicated routes, that will do it. The other thing that's a growth industry, and this is where Hank really specializes, is in the courier business, where you don't have to have a CDL. You don't have to be 21. This is a place that can have some of these drivers getting involved in it and then graduate into the 18-wheeler. Now they're used to on the highway and things like that. But there is going to be a real pressure. But the problem we have is some of them. Rico, I heard today on the Road Dog Radio show, Mark Willis's show, that Georgia just added some money in their budget to put 3 driver training schools in their vocation schools. And that will be a positive thing because you can do everything in vocational school from being a cook to being a mechanic, but you don't get trained to be a truck driver. So you know, they right. are paying attention to this. So some of the education requirements and some of the dollars to educate and some of the restrictions there are positive. But, again, I don't think the insurance industry is going to accept the 18-year-old driver except for rare exceptions with fleets. And this is going to be how, what kind of training program the fleet has and how they're going to quantify it later. But as you just said, Chuck, we listened to the part that Rico just went through. There's a shortage on capacity and there's a shortage on drivers. And what's better to fill those seats? I mean, how, what's the difference between quantity and quality? And, you know, what's the definition right. of quality? I've got an 18-year-old son. I mean, I've got a 50-year-old son. I wouldn't trust him to go around the corner because he's an artist and all that. But, you know, I got a daughter who at 18 could do this because she's more disciplined at that part of right. it. So, you know, we missed the old entryway where, Chuck, you know my father and all. He drove a truck from the farm. You know, he started that
right.
way, around the corner. We don't have that
Not
industry both. Anymore that people no. go into that.
Exactly. And, you know, part of the issue now is, and always has been, but, you know, you did have the best truck drivers we've ever had, you know, for the most part in our company have been farm boys because they, and it doesn't matter where they're from, you know, right now we seem to have an awful lot from Southeast Asia, but nonetheless, they're all farm boys. And they grew up with tractors and combines and all sorts of stuff, so they've got that mechanical sense. And because they're farm boys, they don't get flustered, because farmers can't get flustered, because too much stuff happens with weather and cattle running away and crops ruined and everything else. You learn patience. But unfortunately, because of the dynamics of farming, we're running out of farm boys all over because big agribusiness is taking it over. So what's happened now is the people we could get behind the wheel of a truck at 18 years old, they finish high school, they don't want to go to college, and instead of going into trucking because they can't get near a big rig, obviously, till they're at least 21, in a lot of cases 23 or 25, they choose other paths. And by the time they're old enough when they could get a job and enter the for-hire trucking industry, they're already doing something else. They're crane operators. They're working on construction sites. They're millwrights. There's all sorts of things that they end up doing. And our industry never gets a chance to hire them. But at the same time, we are losing a lot of good people. Number one, we're losing because they're aging out. And number two, we're losing them because of the way the world, and I'm not saying the industry, because there's some segments of the industry and some companies that treat their drivers like gold. There are other ones that don't. But, you know, it's just like last year, a great example is during the beginning of the pandemic in March, and they closed down truck stops and they closed down rest areas. Where were these people supposed to stop and relieve themselves or have a rest? And the law mandates that they have to stop and take a rest. And we treat this sector like dirt. Nobody wants to do it. All the politicians in Washington and in Ottawa are running around saying, we got to fix this. Well, first way you fix it is treat the guys and girls with respect. That's the first thing we do. And then we got to go a little bit deeper.
Chuck, I want to say two things, then we'll let Hank get involved in this. That's where you and I are coming to the same place about getting them interest early. That's why I brought up the trade school that George is doing here, that maybe we get them here. I mean, we don't want the rejects when they fail three other jobs. We want somebody who knows how to do it in the right training. The other thing is pandemic also shut down driver training schools and some of the requirements because they couldn't get more the people in the cabs anymore. And all because of social distancing and stuff, and so that is not graduating the people from the school. Whether it is, as you say, someone who wants to get in this industry because they did something else. I got a friend of mine who called me up who's now quasi retired, and he says, well, "How about becoming a truck driver? You know, I want to travel and this kind of stuff. I've already, you know, done this with this profession I had. What do you think?" And I told him it, you know, sounds good to me. It's just a tough life. He's got to get used to it. But you got people like that. But there's been no grad. there's been no graduates from going to school, and in fact, there's not been any test sites for the to get the CDL test, at least the performance test, because of the pandemic. So, you know, that's compounded the backlog. And one other thing is the drug testing situation, because what happens now is that the people are failing drugs. I've heard a statistic less than I think 18, 19, let's do 20% of those do not apply to go through the rehab so they can drive again. They drop out, which means that they are a part of a social event, and the main reason they're failing is marijuana or medical marijuana, so they're not even trying to get back into it and respect that. So we got a lot of dynamics working with us.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
That's,
and you know what?
That's great point. Great
a whole
point.
Other thing. Yeah, and I'd love Hank to weigh in on this whole thing, because what went on in my country here is up in Canada, we legalized marijuana a couple of years ago. And I see the U.S. really struggling with this one, where I think you're probably going to, you're legalizing it state by state. And I think what's going to probably happen is at some point this administration may legalize it. I don't know where that leaves people in the trucking industry when you have a legalized substance that you're not allowed to take. So, Hank, weigh in, please.
Yeah,
I want to hear this.
When Tommy told me the topic, I said, well, you know, I'm not sure that's necessarily in my wheelhouse, but I did tell him this. I told him that I had two sons who are now in their 30s and they're productive members of society, but they went through what I called delayed onset maturity, and neither one of them would have made good truck drivers at 18. It was call it wild oats, call it whatever you want. The thinking wasn't right, and I'm not sure that they would have had the diligence to stay in a driver training program. And if they did, I certainly don't think they made very good long haul truckers. I think that is part of the issue. Hopefully I can say it being a white male, but I think that there's probably a good chance that the gals coming up in trucking are probably a safer, more diligent group at 18 than some of the guys. So I have some concerns about the average maturity level of a high school senior for the job, but I think Tommy really hit at the core of it, which is ultimately plaintiff's bar is going to take any carrier to task who has a boy that comes up or girl who comes up through their driver training program and then makes a state on the highway. And I think because 18 or 19-year-old behind the wheel is such fair game, the insurance companies are probably going to say, well, if you're a long-haul trucking company, our average age is 22. We've got a standard that's stricter than the law requires, but we know that's what SMS is all about. You're licensed, authorized, and insured, but plaintiff's bar goes to picking you away. So I think the viability of recruiting a whole lot of people in the 18 to 21 to drive long haul is going to meet that as a problem. I think the question about getting people into the industry in less than 10,000-pound GVW makes sense. I've kind of tracked over the past few years this whole idea of increasing the driver training restrictions. I'm very much for states setting the standards and putting people through a truck driving school. I supported one in a town called Dixon, Tennessee, that was PTDIA certified, and you know, the real interest was in training the people in the rural area to get good paying jobs, and it wasn't just to turn them out and get a check. And I think that's important. So, you know, I think it can be dealt with, but I think there's going to be resistance, particularly in the long haul market, putting people on the road for long distance. The idea of keeping them close, I think, makes sense. I think the idea of really developing a great finishing program, particularly on second seat drivers, is essential. Some of the cost estimates I've seen from the truck driving schools, where you pay somebody to ride second street seat around a lot, gets it to be pretty expensive. You know, to fly an airplane, you got to have so many hours before you solo.
Sure.
That probably makes some good sense, not just to be sure he can back into the dock, but also that he's, particularly if you put him out on the load, you get a chance to see what his driving personality is.
Can I bring up something? Couple of things, Chuck. I want to go back. I want back to Hank for a second. Hank, you remember the Warner case? One of the alleged concerns there, it was with a trainee driver, and the trainer was not paying attention. That was part of the bad award. That was something the plaintiff's attorney brought up. And even though the driver did nothing wrong, that was something they threw at the jury to get that, $400 million judgment, or it wasn't that much, but whatever it was. The other thing that we have, and I've looked at this, Hank, and you'll be interested, Chuck, too. We're looking at the conference now. There's a lot of new technology. I looked at one here today for overdrive. In fact, Aaron Huff wrote an article in CCJ Magazine about a company that is tracking the activities of a driver and sending messages to them when they're speeding, and this is not camera driven. This is from the EMC of the truck and ELD of the truck to monitor those drivers in training. And some of that will help some of these younger drivers, because it'll even tell them where they're not paying attention, where they're on the phone and things like that, things that they would tend to do, and this would be a constant policing, not necessarily policing, but a reminder of things. So we've got also not only look at the new regulation training school, but what kind of technology can we put in a truck to assist that driver? Chuck, I remember on the panel where we talked 2 years ago, hopefully it'll be in Orlando again in October, that's what our plans are, you talked about when or Williams talked about putting a quarter in a phone, calling my father about what to do next, you know. And now that frustration because he wouldn't call it back. Now all that's done electronically. I mean, it's there. Everybody's keeping track of everything. And that's a positive move for some of the anxiety on the road, as well as some of the continuing monitoring it. But you're talking about fleets doing this. Hank, you might have heard, Chuck, I don't know if you heard or Rocco's heard about it, one of the complaints of the smaller motor carriers is that these larger motor carriers are just doing it so they got cheaper drivers. And, of course, that would be a real negative part of it. Of course, they might pay for more insurance costs, and that will offset paying for a cheaper driver. But that's one of the downsides to this training part of it. But I think the FAST Act has a lot of support in Congress.
Yeah, you know, the idea of it makes sense. Tom, you said something very very true at the beginning, where you take an 18-year-old and you run him or her on a steady run every day. Well, what about if that 18-year-old met another 18-year-old who was 300 miles up the line, and that's how they run these things the way we used to. I never did much of that. We did a little bit of it. But when I got into this business 47 years ago, LTL and truckload was work, you know, that it was like a relay race. And I believe
Chuck, let me tag team you on that, buddy. I think with what the Department of Labor is intending to do with over-the-road trucking, it will be impossible to afford an employee who's not home every night, because if they reinterpret an overnight stay as being on the clock 15 hours a day or 16 hours a day, and apply overtime, you're going to find that all of a sudden truck drivers on a transcontinental move are making $22.50 an hour for about 100 hours a week. So, I mean, if that goes really crazy, I think you're going to see a return to the relay. It's not that it's the Pony Express model. It's not that the horses die out. It's the riders do. So I can see a situation in which you could put a young man in a daylight job driving from Nashville to Memphis on a turn you know, slip seating in Memphis, particularly as an alternative to a team operation, because you know, they're always looking at, well, what compensation does the guy get for being in the sleeper berth? That will you know, the return to that, I think, is a very real possibility with some of the things I see going on over the Department of Labor.
You've got that aspect, and you also have the cost of a new truck. You know, if you just now, I'm only quoting on Canadian prices because I don't know what your prices are in the U.S., but for a basic truck like a Freightliner, and I'm not talking about the Peterbilts and Kenworths, but a basic Freightliner is somewhere about $170,000. That's a real basic one without a lot of bells and whistles. And you can easily throw another $30,000 into these things with some options. The problem is, if you're running single, running 70 hours a week, you cannot afford to run that asset. So this way, you get away from these trucks. You go to smaller day cabs that are a lot less expensive. You run them 24 hours a day, and they're lighter, and they get better fuel mileage. So the trucking companies, that is, I think, the future of trucking. I think that the only place we're going to continue to see the over-the-road business that we've seen develop for the last 45 years or so is going to be for refrigerated, especially produce, and for flatbed, because those are very specialized, especially some of the oversized stuff. And I think for everything else, it just... Go ahead, Nick.
Chuck, you know that, you know, my crystal ball is just as hazy as everybody else's, but I really think that in the next 4 years there will be a serious run at the independent contractor owner operator model, and you know what the fallout from that is, I don't know, but you've got that tendency, and you're absolutely right that if the owner-operator model is something that I support. I think it's important for small individual entrepreneurship. I hate to see the convergence of unionization and a whole bunch of other things making it not financially reasonable. But I think when that happens, that you're right, there is going to be ultimately platooning, but in the meantime, a lot of relaying in order to get productivity, which will tend to make truck driving, you know, a 10-hour day shift job. I'm not sure that fits the entrepreneurship we're looking at, but that way you do get productivity out of the equipment. You are able to use your telemetrics to be sure you know where that truck is, and eliminate the conditions. And I think that Tommy is absolutely right with the telemetrics and those things. That may be that, you know, the driver is just sitting there to be sure that the truck doesn't malfunction, but it's doing 90% of the driving.
Yeah, well, you know, look at the trucks now, what they've got available, you know, between the cruise control, automated transmission, collision avoidance systems, lane departure systems, like also rollover avoidance systems. They're getting really good at this. with the artificial intelligence, which is going to allow us to be able to take a less experienced individual and put him or her behind the wheel. Because these aren't 1966 Mack trucks anymore. You know, these are very expensive, very technically advanced pieces of equipment.
Yeah, there's no gear jamming required, you know. It lends itself to being an easier drive than it certainly did 20 years ago.
Oh, yeah, and they're more comfortable. One of the things that I will say from, you know, the comments on what you just said about the 10-hour day and predictability, that would probably solve some of the driver issues. Because now all of a sudden you've got route drivers that know their route, they know their timetable, they can schedule a life at home, they can take their little kid to baseball or soccer or ballet or whatever the child does for an extracurricular activity. They don't have to tear the heart out of families, which our industry can be hard on, as we all know. And we give that predictability to people, which is something that today people are craving. I don't think that I think that the whole idea of the long-haul trucker being the last American cowboy, I think that's written off into the golden sunset. I think people are more aware of the harsh reality of this job, hence they don't want to do it, just for that reason. And for most people, it would just take one trip in the winter going from coast to coast and seeing what these people go through trying to find a parking spot, being mistreated at shippers and receivers, at scale houses, lining up for fuel, not being able to pull over when they need to, et cetera, et cetera. We could go on. And that's why we've got the driver problem. And as I've said before, and I'll say it again tonight, I think the biggest mistake that the USA made before they started messing with e-logs and hours of service and everything else, they should have fixed the parking problem first. That was... If they would have done that, I think we would have had a much different outcome.
There's some movement to try to address some of that parking, but I agree with everything you're saying. But the other thing is the economy has changed, where now you've got just-on-time delivery. There's a great need for drivers there, and as Hank and I were talking about, that's a good entry place of it. And whether we like it or not, now we got to think about the future, because by the time an 18-year-old driver becomes anywhere near acceptable in the marketplace at any kind of level, we'll have autonomous vehicles. We'll have vehicles to be able to drive, at least platooning or not. Hank, I think you agree with me, where there'll be one in the front and controlling the one in the back with a younger driver, as you said, doing anything here, moving it from
point. An old Army convoy, you know, the 17-year-old third vehicle back, you just got to watch the taillights of the guy in front of you.
Yeah, and it's going to be some of that part, because we're moving close to that. I mean, we got some technology. One reason I'm saying we're moving close to that, there's a lot of money in that. When you look at the money these companies are raising, and they're doing one thing that you might not have noticed, is some of these technology companies are now partnerships with PACCAR and Navistar and the truck manufacturers.
Oh, yeah.
So they're getting that technology with the OMCs. That part of it. So, you know, when we think about this, we're talking about a long play in this, and it's not going to happen overnight. But I personally believe, Hank, and I haven't studied anywhere near you because I'm just a guy who reads transport topics, this kind of stuff. I think there's a lot of provisions in the FAST Act as far as driver training and this kind of stuff that's positive part of it. And it might be a good introduction to thinking about these younger drivers.
Yeah, you may be right. I've got to confess that I've been far more concerned about the independent contractor model than I have the goodies that are in the legislation you're talking about. But I do think if we're coming up with vectors of change, the autonomous vehicle is one. the labor union changing hours and controls and some of those things is clearly another. The independent contractor model is the backbone of refrigerated long haul, particularly intermodal. You know, I was on Ellen Voigt's show last Saturday, and we were talking about that.
I heard you, by the way. Go ahead.
And if you did, you probably felt me smile with the response from those people. The guy said, "What's going to happen if they do away with the contractors and all of us that got payments on our trucks?" And I mean, you know, that's only about 1 million folks. So, you know, I think that's the one that's really going to affect pickle haulers and the sons of pickle haulers.
Yeah,
but speak about Ellen Voyer and also statistics. The female driver, and she was our lead off speaker at our virtual conference we had, and we're going to do a session on drivers and address some of the stuff at the new conference and this part of it. But statistics show they're better drivers. They're more patient. They have the discipline to be there. And from a statistics standpoint, and I totally agree with you. I think, Chuck, when you said that maybe that's a place where we find more acceptability with younger drivers is in the female driving force.
Actually, Hank said that, but I agree. I have to say, in all the years we've been doing this, the best drivers overall have been females, and we haven't had enough of them. I was just fortunate enough to hire one as an owner operator. She just started with us last weekend, and I agree with both of you. There's a calmness and there's a competence about them that you don't get. They're not cowboys the way guys are. They're just different. They're more professional. And the term, and I'm going to steal this from the late Zig Ziglar, the term he used is called unconscious competence, and that's when people just do things naturally. You know, they automatically check their brakes. Watch them do a circle check. Watch a guy do a circle check. And, you know, sometimes when you watch them, if you don't go out and yell at them, they drive away without checking the air on the tires. But, you know, women being who they are and being the nurturers, and also I think because of what they have to go through, they will take the extra 5-10 minutes and check tire pressure because they don't want, they're not going to risk having that blown tire on the road if they can help it. If there's something that they can control, they will. And that's a good thing. And unfortunately, we don't have enough women drivers in our industry. We have a driver shortage, but we certainly, the gender ratio is probably, and one of you guys may have a number better than me, but I would say it's probably 95 or 96% male.
Yeah, and
Alvin's bills is about 8 or 9% are actually truck drivers, and about 15% are in transportation, counting mechanics and people, dispatchers and things like that.
But I think we all remember. 15 or 20 years when a trucking job for a woman was kind of like being in construction. There really was a gender bias in terms of the way men treated women in the business. So before I did thing with Ellen, I called a buddy of mine who's got a trucking company in a rural area, and I said, give me a sanity check. I said, what is your attitude and the attitude of your owner-operator group to women? And his response is, they're a pearl of great price. He said, by and large, their paperwork is in order. They're the safest people we've got. Any of the old stereotypes have pretty much gone away. And I was very pleased to hear that. So I think that I don't want to, obviously, the idea of no touch freight, the idea of no more gear jamming and those kinds of things has made it, not to the point that you have to have some guy who's 6'4" and can lift a, 100-pound sack over his head to do the job. And I think all of those things have really helped insinuate women. And I think that's the source of needed drivers. I think by and large the truck owners would certainly welcome that.
And that's something that I think has kind of changed in being a lot more. The women in trucking has become a lot more. Definitely, the amount of women that have come into the industry has definitely increased over time, and it's kind of become almost a little bit of a movement of its own.
Very much so.
Absolutely.
Let's give me
a minute here because I think we got a lot of things going on, but let's circle around. First off, there needs to be something done. And I think some of the moves, more education, more driver school, more support for trade schools and all, we've got to introduce people to this industry to be a truck driver sooner. The other thing is a truck driver can make a lot of money. I'm looking at the pay now. I mean, I'm looking at some articles here, the $89,000 a year. That's only after 2 or 3 years, Chuck, that you could raise that level. And there's very few professions that can accelerate that quickly based on how much they're willing to work. And that's the big part about trucking. The other thing, Hank, I understand, and I'm a big supporter of independent contractors, truckers, and all that, as you well know. But that's not an 18-year-old. They're not going to be an independent contractor. They're not going out here and buy their own truck and do that. They're going to be an employee for a period of time. So that's also with that pressure, that model, that might even have more people starting there. You follow what I'm saying? As one of the introductions to it, as the pressure is made for the independent contractor model, the pressure on the independent contractor model. The thing that surprised me, Hank, and I don't know your reaction, but as you know, there are more new authority granted last year than in the history. There are more people right now with MC numbers than ever been.
Well, listen, the numbers for January and February suggest that there will be 100,000 new applicants this year. Now, I'm trying to drill down on that number. I think that one of the reasons is when large carriers are exiting California and trying to go to power only, they're encouraging a lot of owner operators to procure their own authority. And I've had a number of calls in the past couple of weeks, referrals from NASDIC and other folks that are owner operators, maybe have had been a fleet operator for another company, that are looking to get into it. And I think we've always figured that owner-operator is kind of the incubator for small carriers. I can't tell you how many guys have their names on the side of trucks that started off as owner-operators. So I think that pipeline towards new small carriers is threatened if the owner-operator model isn't there kind of as an apprenticeship, if you'd have it. How to manage the truck, get your taxes in order, do those things. Because then, the difference between being an owner-operator, being guaranteed a percentage of the revenue and being paid with truth in leasing regulations is, in a way, a whole lot safer thing than having to shag loads in the spot market and fill out all the state forms and those things. So I think the loss of the model will really adversely affect the birthing of new small carriers.
I totally agree with you. We're
We're moving. I've been saying this, Hank. I've been dooming smaller carriers for years, just all the paperwork. I mean, I make the comment, and of all of us, Chuck knew my father. My father had very little education. My father was smart enough to be a trucker, but he was not educated enough to be a trucker when he became a trucker. Chuck, I think you agree with me, would you not, with that synopsis?
Well,
it's just now,
pretty smart guy. He had some bad luck, that's all. But he, in the end, he did very well with his pickle business.
Yeah,
so,
I'm not complaining, but my point is that it takes more. He came out of high school and became a trucker. It takes more knowledge, more computer, more awareness of those kind of things today than ever before, with everything going on.
Michael.
That's the point I'm making.
I mean, technology. We're talking about that. You know, all this wonderful technology and artificial intelligence in the trucks. Management has to be able to manage that, and if you aren't computer and technically savvy, you can't manage. You can't manage your business.
Well, and you know, there's another thing going on, and I'm sure you guys see it, and that is after deregulation, we had a wonderful flood of people getting in it and becoming all-star heroes in the past 40 years. There's a reconsolidation going on, though, guys. I mean, really think with the telemetrics and the cost and all of that, it's going to be hard for the little country truck line to compete, in large part because it used to be a face-to-face deal with the plant president, and he called you when he was really in a jam and you had a relationship. Now it seems to be left to the computers to sort out, and it may just be my age and stage, but you know, a lot of folks in their 50s and 60s are looking at, no, I don't want to give this over to my son. I need to sell out. Hank, find somebody to buy me.
Well,
and,
you know,
I hate to see that.
Yeah. You know, some of these businesses are third generation, and they just decided that they're going to sell because it's become a difficult business. Just from the nuclear settlements alone is enough to scare somebody's pants off. You know, and if they can cash out. And then the other part, like you say, it's the costs. You know, if they can get bought out by a large company, a mega carrier who can insure them cheaper, then all of a sudden they're going to make that much more money. So you can see where, you know, a lot of these families that are multi-generational are starting to say, you know what, we either need to buy another company or sell ours because it's got to be bigger. You know,
well, yeah, when there's great financial disruption, a lot of people are looking for cash in their chips and being satisfied because of the great unknown. And you know, I think it's hard for you know, a 15-20 truck fleet to insinuate itself into dealing with large carriers, particularly we saw it when they had, it wasn't Covoit, it was called Covisant, and they come out and do a reverse auction on the bids. There's still a whole lot of that going on, and it doesn't seem to me to be a real premium for service or relationships. Groups like Delta Nu Alpha and Traffic Clubs and those kinds of things that it used to be where there was a real bond between shippers and carriers, I think has largely been overtaken by procurement law. And frankly, it's not the same collegiality that we used to have.
No, not at all. And you know what? And to try to live, this is where carriers are getting into trouble. They're trying to build a business on the spot market. And you just, you know, running here, there, and everywhere. We talk about it all the time on this show, and it doesn't work. You need to, you know, you can have steady broker customers that send you to the same places, or you can have steady direct customers. You know, that's how you run your business, but you've got to have steady. You can't be going here, there, and everywhere. and who's got the best rate today, and that's who you're going to give your truck to, because your business isn't going to be worth anything. At least if you have customers, you have a good chance of, you know, somebody's going to want to buy it one day when you decide to sell it.
And that relationship has to be based on productivity of the driver and them doing their job. And, again, smaller motor carriers are not able to prove to these shippers, we can handle your needs right now. Think about the shortage of truckers. Chuck, you know this. You tell me right now, and listen to what Rico was talking about, the spot market, how the prices are up. There's a need for trucks today. And it's getting worse. It's not getting better. It's exasperated by the driver shortage, but and so where are these shippers going to turn to fill these needs to move this product? I mean, it's going to be something we're going to have to face in the next, I think, year or so. Hopefully the economy stays good, so that will be something that that's the only thing that could change that outlook.
I was talking to a broker client yesterday, and, kind of trying to feel out what he was doing. He said, look, he says, I don't want to be the first call. He said, there's such a shortage. I'll put in a bid on freight, and, I won't get all the first calls. Let those guys fight for it. But he says, when I get a load on that board, I got enough money in it to hire somebody who's good and make some money. And I think that, those people who go in and say, well, I'll grab it all, are really playing arbitrage with what they're doing. They give a low ball price, and then when the market when the market is high, they make a killing, and they just kind of it's kind of like these guys in gameplay or whatever it is. It's not just the role of a broker being like a real estate broker. I'm going to take 6%, and here we go. That's part of why I think OIDA's is so upset. They're seeing people gouging rates, but from their point of view, they've got to make up for it as they can, because they guaranteed a rate, and are basically some days having to pay more than they got in it.
Lots of times, Hank, I got to tell you, you have no idea how frequently we end up having to pay more to cover a load than what we're ever getting. You have to run a truck from Chicago all the way down to Peoria or St. Louis sometimes to pick up a load because you've got a commitment. But that's a customer that gives you, 100 loads a year. So you lose money sometimes. That's the cost of doing business. You want to keep that customer. And, as long as you're willing to do that, you stay in business. Whether you're a truck owner, you have to do that to keep your customer happy, or a broker. It's all about customer service.
Yeah, but, we could talk philosophically about this. If the role of the broker, it was originally intended, was kind of like a real estate broker in that he was bringing together a willing buyer and a willing seller who set the price, and he made a commission, then, it was a volume deal. But over the years, the role of the broker has become as a non-asset-based provider. And so,
right.
you're buying and selling the product. You're taking the liability for the cargo loss or damage, and the ability of the broker to really keep the kind of accounting records the rules require. Who did you bill? When did he pay the freight charges, and when did you transmit it to the carrier? Those whole things kind of assumes that you got some markup, not that when you get paid from your shipper, you're $400 short. Because that's not the constructive trust. If I take a contingency fee on a collection question, then and I get paid $10,000, and I got a 30% commission, then I can very easily keep the accounting and put it in a trust and send the client the
right
agreed amount. But if otherwise I'm just buying and selling transportation, then I'm not a fiduciary anymore. I'm a principal. And that distinction is really an important one. it ends up being okay, that a little guy can't play that game.
But I got to say one thing. What happens in the case where I'm moving loads for a soda pop company and I give loads to a whole bunch of small mom and pop carriers and the soda pop company goes bankrupt? I still pay the carriers even though I take a hit for maybe $200,000 or $300,000. Can't have it both ways.
Well, look, I certainly understand that. But, you know, the question is, an honest man getting into business that's not well healed is going to have that as a hell of a problem. We get involved in a fair amount of bankruptcy in which a broker gets stiffed by some customer who went bankrupt. Now, if he promised to pay his carriers in full, regardless of whether he got paid, I've had situations in which the broker has been an honest man, but he's just flat out of business. And everybody says, "Where's my money?" If he says, on the other hand, that I'll endeavor to pay you on 30 days or upon receipt of money from the client, then that recognizes the constructive trust. I'm just saying there are two different ways to do it, but you've always. My little brokers always have a hard time competing on being a non-asset-based provider against the Magnificent Seven, the guys that have got so
right.
much money that the broker says, "Well, listen, I can't haul for Seton Brokerage. I never heard of them." But then there's that big guy. You know, I'm getting less, but he'll give me terminal pay. So I guess it's a different philosophical situation. I think if I were a carrier, I'd rather have recourse to the shipper and say, okay, if Mr. Broker, if you're good enough for Apple, you're good enough for me because ultimately Apple's my customer.
Let me circle back around, though. We started talking about younger drivers, and I appreciate all that broker because I'm thinking about my father negotiating with Vlasic Foods, Chuck, which you did a good job, and the rest
right.
of that stuff. Let's circle back. They're going to be the possibility of a younger driver hauling interstate. When you look at the FAST Act,
yep.
there's a lot of, Smart Act, there's a lot of things in there for
yeah.
education and all. But the insurance industry is going to be real reluctant to accept that, and the first place it's going to start is risks that are assuming a lot of retention, where they got their own $1 million out. They got their only $500,000 out. Those risks will end up being able to have that, but that insurance company and that risk is going to make sure that motor carrier who has that much skin in the game is going to make sure that driver is not only trained, is retrained and monitored to do this part of it and ease it in.
Right.
That's where it's going to start. But I think 18-year-old drivers will become a part of the marketplace, maybe not in my lifetime, but Chuck and yours part of it, because we just got to fill the void. And the idea to start it at vocation schools and have something for them coming out of school to move into this profession is a very positive thing. And maybe that is something we'll see that will put more education in to do that. But that's where I want to circle back around, that the insurance, even though it's going to be able to do it, the insurance industry is going to be a hurdle. It's got to be over because that's a risk. And sooner or later, we'll be able to monitor that risk and charge for it.
Well,
yeah.
Gentlemen,
I'm
looking at the time, and it's generally, we don't never always have enough when we have all you guys on, so we're going to have to come back around and figure out what the next topic of discussion is. It's always fascinating when we get the whole game together. So I want to let the listeners know really quickly, for Hank Seton, if you want to get in contact with Hank, if you want to need his services or anything that he may be able to offer, you need to order the book. You can do all that over at www.transportationlaw.net. All things Hank Seton, you can find him over there. Tommy, I don't know your information. You want to tell the people how they can get in contact with you?
It's very simple. MCIEF.org, Motor Carriers Insurance Education Foundation.org, O-R-G. That's our website. My email address is my name at MCIEF.org.
All we have to do, we don't charge for anything. All we have to do is give information out. We don't sell insurance, and we answer questions, and we'll help the driver work through whatever problems they have. And if we need to refer a lawyer, Hank's on that list that we can refer him to. Which we do that sometimes, too, when they're calling us. But that's where we are with that. And thank you for doing this. Guys, thanks a lot. We appreciate the time you letting us do this stuff.
Thanks, Tommy. Appreciate you coming on.
Chuck, your turn, my friend. Let's wrap it up and bag this thing into the hole.
Okay. If you want to reach me, give me a call, extension 203. And the phone number is 800-388-4352. And you can send me an email, traffics.com. And you can try reaching me on Instagram, Chuck Snow, CEO. And with that, this was a great show, Rico. Thank you so much for all your help. Tommy and Hank, thank you for joining us. Great show. Thanks again.
Great show. And thanks to you guys that make the show go around. You guys, the listeners, could have been anywhere else in the world, but we always are eternally grateful if you spend a few moments with us. So until the next time, you guys stay safe, stay healthy, and as always, keep it in between the mustard and the mayonnaise. We'll talk to you next week. God bless you and good night.
Good night.
Catch you on the flip. Good night.